really happy that Ruth Bencevitz can be with us this evening. So Ruth, as you can see here, she's at the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, which is at Cambridge, University of Cambridge in England. She's a senior researcher there. Her background is in genetics, so that's where her PhD work is, and postdoc work is there. So she's interested both in the real science, but also in how it is that theology fits in with that. How should Christians, you know, think about these kinds of things? And what she's going to talk about tonight is based on a new book that she just published. So the book is actually shares the same title as God in the Lab, How Science Enhances Faith. So you may, you should go look for this book.
We think it might be in the campus bookstore. We're not completely sure, but there are certainly flyers over there.
Yes, so there are flyers over here on this table if you want to take one with you. And there also are little sort of information cards about the Faraday Center. If you're looking for a place that has resources on science and faith, you know, go to the website. There are lots of cool things there. Also the American Scientific Affiliation is another organization you can look up that has cool things there. Some of our members are here tonight because we announced that to them as well. So, without any further ado, please welcome Ruth.
Okay, and I'll just choke on my throat, sweet, to start with. Which is not a very good move, but I'll start by telling you a little bit about myself. I am Scottish. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We don't have a day. Oh, no, we have Burns Day. They invented one for us, too. Burns Night. But, thank you for turning out in your green. And I studied at Aberdeen University and then Edinburgh University. I did genetics. I actually did a lot of molecular biology, some developmental biology, not much of the math side of genetics. Don't ask me about population biology. So I did my PhD. I was about to move to Philadelphia to a lab there, and then decided that actually I wasn't quite patient enough to work into the lab. I was gravitating towards my desk. I really enjoy the reading, the writing, the speaking. I wasn't quite patient enough for experiments. I wanted to get into science communication, working in science museums, or we have science festivals in the UK. You probably have something similar here. And I thought, hey, I'm writing these passionate letters about how everyone should learn about science. Maybe I thought, gosh, how could I apply this in a faith context? And then this job for Christians in Science came up, which is like the ASA, which you have here. And I applied, I got it. So I started working in the area of science and faith, which was fun. And then the Faraday Institute started up in 2006. It was set up by a couple of members of Christians in Science. It's a secular academic institute based in one of the colleges of Cambridge University. It's pretty unique. One of the few places where we have a prayer meeting every week in Cambridge, probably. My job is to take in the academic material and then turn out something that the general public can understand. So I realise that many of you are academics and students, but I'm sure you're not all scientists. Or maybe some of you are. Can you put your hand up if you consider yourself a scientist or a science student? Can I see? Okay, lots. Not everyone. Okay. And my church background, I'm a Christian. I go to a charismatic evangelical denomination called New Frontiers. They're very supportive of what I'm doing, although there are a range of opinions within that denomination. And the aim of my work, the aim of the book that I'm so shamelessly publicising to you tonight, and also what I want to say to you, is to talk about the best parts of what it's like to be a person of faith working in science. We hear lots of issues, lots of debates. They're really important. I know that students here at Wheaton get a chance to dig into those, and that's absolutely fabulous. And Christian scientists, certainly in the UK, are occasionally called up if they're a really high flyer. Scientists, they get the BBC, maybe they find them on the Faraday website. I hope that's not my phone. Probably is. they say, we want you to go head-to-head with Richard Dawkins, please. I actually got asked to do that. I said, no, I didn't think I'd survive. I was like, no, ask me in 10 years, and I'll be competent enough to do that. But, you know, and you get put up against someone, polar opposites, you know, and it's good to take those opportunities. People need to step up to the mark and do that if they feel qualified. But we don't often get to start the conversation. And I think people deserve to find out that doing science can actually help your faith to grow. Now, I realise I'm kind of preaching to the converted here in Wheaton, because I walk through your science centre and there's Bible verses everywhere and awe and wonder all over the place. It's great. But it won't do you any harm to talk about it more. The theologian, British theologian Alistair McGrath, he challenged, well, not me specifically, but I was sitting in the audience and also working with him as he said this. We do the responding, it's good, but we need to go on the front foot as well. We need to start the conversations, we need to set the cultural agenda, we need to tell people about this. The fact that science can enhance your faith. And Oliver Barclay, who was the one of the founders of the InterVarsity movement when it, you know, the brand that's become InterVarsity when it was being started in the UK, you know, talked about how we should focus on the wonder of the world when I was working for Christians in Science. He was one of the founders of that organisation too, and he said, yeah, we do have different opinions about things, but we need to remember that this can lift our eyes to worship God. For example, that you have enough DNA in your body to take you to Pluto and back at least 6 times, or more, depending on where its orbit is, and about 300 times to the Sun. I keep checking that figure because it's too incredible. But it's true. 2 meters of DNA inside every cell in your body, and billions of cells. So it doesn't take that long to work out the maths. Look it up on Wikipedia. He's great. It expands my view of the world. It expands my view of the great God that I worship. So this is the focus of my work, giving ordinary scientists a voice. Here are the guys that I worked with, guys and girls. I don't work in a lab anymore. I haven't for 10 years, so I can talk all I like about wonder, but I need a real working scientist to say, yes, Ruth, you haven't gone off track here. So that's what these guys are here for. And they have been involved in this the last few years as I've been writing the book. And when I ask scientists, actually it started, my research started at an ASA meeting in Naperville, not far from here, and I said, you know, if you get to start the conversation, you're not allowed to respond to anything, you're not allowed to talk about anything negative, what would you say? And they talked about beauty, awe, wonder, some of them talked about creativity in science, and of course that's related to imagination. All these things help our faith to grow. Last bit of the preamble, these are things that human beings care about. We care about beauty, you know, so it's a great bridge builder to talk about conversations in science and faith. There are commonalities that I realised as I did my reading between the practice of science and the practice of Christian faith. When we get onto imagination, I'll show you that in parallel. And also they raise theological, philosophical questions. You stand back in awe, and often when people, whether they're a Christian or not, when they're looking at the universe, they use spiritual language. Why do we do that? Is it just in our vocabulary, or is it because we're feeling spiritual? Is there something spiritual going on? Those are good questions to ask. So I'm not making arguments for God from science. I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm probably not even going to use the word evidence. So I'm really cautious about doing that within science, because science is always changing. But I want to do something more foundational. I want to provide, or to remind people, or provide information to help them think, well, I have something in common with my colleague who's not Christian, or my relative who keeps going on about science as if it excludes God, but then enjoys the awe and wonder of the world. I think we can learn from each other. I'm also not going to, as I said, I'm not going to discuss issues, so I'm not going to get onto Genesis, I'm not going to get onto ethics. You can do that other times. Tonight, this is your menu. I'm going to talk very briefly, how do science and faith interact, just a kind of recap. Then I'm going to talk about wonder and imagination, that's your meat. that will hopefully make your brain hurt. And then dessert is beauty and awe. I'm sorry if that makes you feel hungry, but there it is. So how does science and Christianity fit together? Well, or more, the question might be incredulous, posed to you, how do they fit together? How can you do that? What have you done to your brain if you're a scientist and you're Christian? Well, here's some nice data. Oh, no, you can't see the bottom of the screen either. I'm sorry. This is Elaine Howard Eklund, who's a sociologist at Rice University, who's done a number of very useful surveys. Google her name and you'll find some useful data. For example, that 61% of US scientists, broadly defined, believe would identify as a Christian. That's exciting. That was more than I expected. Or that's more than some people would expect. General population, about 74%. So there is an issue there, but not as much as some people would say when you hear people shouting about it. So there are lots of people, you know, for whom this is, you know, science and faith do go together. And to find out how they do that, we have to learn, I think, from three areas. First of all, is something people probably don't use these words that often, a theology of science. Where does, what are the theological roots of science, essentially? People has always done science. I've got, you know, a picture of agriculture here, someone looking at the stars, poking around at bugs, travelling off, looking beyond the horizon. We do that. We've got brains, you know, we like using them. And exploring God's world and learning to use things well is a good thing. You know, there's nothing to question about that. You could even say it was a biblical principle behind it. God asked Adam to name the animals. He told him and Eve to work the land, to have dominion over the earth. And science is science is a very sophisticated way of doing that. And for many of the early scientists, their exploration, they didn't call themselves scientists, they called themselves natural philosophers. You know, this was a Christian vocation for them. They were working out their life following Jesus, doing this. And that wasn't controversial for them. So you could work out quite a thorough theology of science if you wanted to. I won't do that now. But then we can also learn from history of science, which is... people have tried to say it's all about conflict, they've tried to say it's all about harmony, but actually it's somewhere in between, quite complicated and nuanced. But broadly you could say, you know, it all started, certainly the history of European science, which is what I'm concerned about. You've got Greek philosophers, you've got things happening in Persia and Egypt and India, and then all that flows on into the Arabic world, people start doing maths, start doing astronomy and medicine, making advances in those areas. And, you know, then eventually those texts make their way to medieval Europe. People start doing science. And there certainly is a feed-in from Christian theology at that point. For example, the idea that God works in regular ways. People like Isaac Newton thought this. Galileo, you know, they were looking for the way God was working in the world. They knew... you know, you see in the Bible, God gives us a day and night, winter and summer, birth and death. He provides this stuff for us. So they went looking for the regular mechanisms that God was upholding. I'm doing this. I don't know how God acts anyway. I just put my hands behind my back. but they knew we had to do experiments. We can't just go out there and assume we know the way the world works. Now, that would be arrogant. We have to be humble and go and look. That was a step of faith and it worked. And that sounds really obvious that you should have to do experiments, but for then it was a bit of a revolution. It wasn't that cool for professors to get their hands dirty. But I'm going to stop before I make the historians of science uncomfortable with my amateur history of science. But it is, it's there. We can learn a lot from the history of science and the philosophy of science. This is such a common illustration. I hope lots of you have seen this before. The kettle's boiling. There are two ways of describing the kettle boiling. You could write a whole essay about the physics, and then you could write a whole essay about the fact that British people drink tea, whether they're thirsty or not, and it has a cultural significance. And do you put the milk in before or after the tea? And what kind of cups do you have? And, you know, what are the cultures of meeting up? What do you say over tea? you know, there's a lot of meaning there. You've got the mechanisms, you've got the meaning, and it would be ridiculous to say that the two exclude each other. But in other, on other subjects, people try and do that. And you can't separate the two either. You know, nobody boils a kettle for no reason. Okay, there's always a meaning. And you can't separate the physics out. You don't, oh, I'm having a meaning tea today. It doesn't work. Although you could probably try and sell it, but it probably sell quite well. So I put this into my model of science and religion working together. This is the Venn diagram of my life. And my Christian faith is the basis of it. They're all the things, some of the things I experience within my Christian life. And science is part of that. I exclude some things. When I was actually doing experiments, I would not pray for a certain result. That would be ridiculous. Why would I tell God how he should have made the world? I might pray I would do it well. And likewise, I don't go out of the lab and start, you know, taking everything I can see apart to see how it works. I don't get excited about, you know, my aunt's cancer or something like that, you know, even though I might be absolutely fascinated by it. It's not appropriate. You know, so we have these boundaries, you know, we just do it. You know, the other things in my life, this diagram is not to scale. Although drawing a scale one might be quite useful when you wonder why you're quite so tired. So this is, you know, this is the way it works, I think. Science is part of my life. And my faith background is there in my behaviour, or it was when I was in the lab. It doesn't control it. So that's kind of the background. Now, combine them all and start looking at how science can enhance faith, how it can raise spiritual questions. So wonder. And isn't this a beautiful picture that my friend Steph took of a dragonfly, I think in Canada? Wonder is a driver of science. This is another friend, Rhoda Hawkins. She's a theoretical physics professor in Sheffield University. And she studies cells as a physicist, which is interesting. She's looking at a biological thing. This is not real time. The green and blue picture is static snapshot. And then now you're seeing a movie of the same kind of cells, speeded up. And she looks at this and thinks, as a physicist, you know, thinking, wow, what's going on there? This is so cool. You know, a biologist takes life for granted, in a sense, but a physicist has to add some extra factors into their equations. You know, you don't expect a blob of hair gel, which is a similar consistency to cells on the shower. You don't expect it to crawl off, you know, which is essentially what these things are doing, you know. And so she's trying to study the forces. It's incredibly difficult mathematics. Most of her equations, she says, don't work most of the time. That's not because she's bad at math. It's because it's really hard. But it excites her. You know, she wants to understand these things. And wonder is driving that study. So I'm going to come back to Rhoda later on. She's a Christian. And I talk to her a lot about wonder. But first of all, I will define awe and wonder, because we often use them interchangeably, and the words have often meant different things. Awe, I think he just saw his sister's new bike. You know, or maybe a whale. Something vast, something powerful, beautiful, complex. Certainly an element of incomprehensibility is what's going to get you to stand there going, wow, I never saw this before. Surprise, admiration, fear, feeling overwhelmed, maybe reverence. Wonder is in there, so it's part of awe. And always, always, I think with awe, this could almost be a definer, is the aspect of mental adjustment. You see something, you've got to stand still for a while to take it in, you know. Whereas wonder, you know, is more active. Daddy, what is it? Can I touch it? Is it good to eat? Can I play with it? I don't know what he's pointing at, but it's exciting. It's new, it's beautiful, it's amazing, he's curious, it's an active feeling. And doubt is there because you might think, I never saw a blue one of those, you know. I didn't know you could have green hair, you know, whatever it is that he's just seen. And you're doubting and you have to revise your thoughts, you know, and you have to, it's like an active hopeful. If awe is just standing still going, wow, wonder is like, let me look. And today we really value wonder. You know, those of you who are here at Wheaton, you know, you're paying a lot of money to learn how to wonder more. You know, you're being trained to do that. But it's, you know, some people have questioned that. This is Keats, the poet, who wrote a poem that you might have heard, Lamia, where he, you know, he says, "Scientists unweave the rainbow." Richard Dawkins made this famous because he wrote a book with the title. But he said, "Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy?" Which is, and then at that point, science was still often called philosophy, natural philosophy. Is it true? Is what you're learning in the science classroom kind of unpicking your wonder? So you're like, nah, rainbow's just light, you know. Yeah, know how it's formed. To some extent, maybe, or maybe not. So I'll tell you a story, which I found very helpful. Margaret Bolden is a cognitive scientist, philosopher, computer scientist, wears many hats at the University of Sussex. And she told a story about a colleague as a mathematician. She didn't name him. But he had told her when he was, well, he said an infant, I'm guessing 2 or 3, he was fascinated by circles. Kids do this. They just pick up on something, get excited about it. A little tiny kid, he collected anything that was circular, kept it in his toy cupboard, used to bring them out and draw around them. And his parents thought, great, geometry. And they said, we're going to get you something that, well, you can draw a circle of any size. Well, there's an upper limit and a lower limit, but, you know, you can expand it and contract it. You can draw all sorts of different sizes of circles. And this kid was so excited because he imagined some kind of magic thing, you know, magic expanding circle in his child head. And he waited and waited for this, and when it came, he was devastated because it was a compass. It looks quite ugly. It's not circular. It works on such a simple principle. He just thought it was boring. He was so disappointed. He actually said it was quite a traumatic moment for him. He was obviously quite a sensitive child. I think his parents probably felt quite bad. So he lost his wonder. You know, poof, off it went. But, you know, he kept his interest in mathematics. He eventually went to university, studied maths, did some geometry, regained his sense of wonder at the circle, you know, the elegant principle behind the compass. So he needed to learn more. He lost his initial sense of wonder, and he needed to learn more before he regained it. Or as Margaret Bolden said, deeper understanding led to deeper wonder, it was a journey from ignorant wonder to informed wonder. I think this can happen in both science and religion. If you're just superstitious, oh, the black cat crossed my path, you know, something's going to happen, you know, whatever, then you're going to be disillusioned if you think that's what faith is all about. And likewise in science, if you think there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, Irish theme, sorry. No. I'm sorry if I just made you sad. You know, you've got to get over it. But then when you really do explore the rainbow, and that's where I could recommend a chapter or two of Richard Dawkins' book about unweaving the rainbow, he really does explain it really nicely, you know, and the rainbows are really cool, and the principles behind them are exciting. So, as Bolden said, when wonder is based on pure ignorance or an error or illusion, it must fade in the light of understanding. But understanding may lead in turn to a new form of wonder which cannot be so easily destroyed. Having done a PhD on zebrafish, I will never lose my sense of excitement when I see a zebrafish. I studied them till my head hurt, and I still didn't lose my fascination with looking at them. And the same with my faith. You know, I'm learning new stuff. I'm being disillusioned as I realize God doesn't play my games. But my faith is getting deeper, and I don't think I will lose it at this stage. So Alistair McGrath, I'll go back to this theologian, his book is kind of one of the textbooks for my book that I've just written. I was very glad that he wrote a foreword for it. His book, The Open Secret, where he puts forward a number of challenges about the created world and how we see that, how that can teach us about God. he mentioned three kinds of wonder. Actually, this wasn't in this book. This was in another paper. First of all, there's the intuitive wonder, which, when it's not based on superstition or weird ignorance like pots of gold, is, you know, is a good thing. You know, you see the rainbow, wow, love it, you know. And you might stand there, especially if it's a double bow, or, you know, there are these extra bows coming off, which you can get when the light is powerful, the sun's really shining, then, you know, that's something to enjoy. Then there's a more derived wonder. This happens for the mathematician when they, you know, they really study things deeper. And then you can have a deeper sense of wonder. And then he picked out another kind of derived wonder, which kind of points towards God. I say it's not evidence, but it's within a Christian framework of thinking. You look at stuff and think, ah, what does this tell me about the Creator? You know, that's exciting. So you might have this whole jumble of data if you're working in a lab, and then you notice a pattern. You come up with a periodic table, if you're lucky, or phylogeny, or you understand the behavior of electrons around an atom, or DNA. And when things slot together, it may not be a sudden, it probably isn't a sudden process, it's an inkling, or a, oh, wouldn't it be exciting if it was that way? And then you're building up, you're, let me look further. Werner Heisenberg, a physicist, summed this up really well, and he said, when one stumbles upon these very simple, great connections, the whole thing appears in a different light. Then our inner eye is suddenly open to a connection which has always been there, also without us, and which is quite obviously not created by man. So this guy was not a Christian, but he used this kind of semi-spiritual language because he was really stunned by what he saw. He was in his 20s when he did some of the foundational work in quantum mechanics. And he wrote some very, very eloquent things about his feelings about what happened when he found that. Now, when you add a Christian component, you get something like what Rhoda Hawkins has said, whose dad is a bishop, who has learned a lot about Christian theology in her life. He said, when I experience wonder at the world around me, wonder at a particular system I've been studying, I have someone to attribute that to. So that, for her, is a very powerful experience. She doesn't get that very often. Most of the time it's, oh, how do I get this equation to work? Or, you know, I need to plan my next lecture. But, you know, from time to time she'll get that feeling. That wonder for me personally is also a wonder at God's creation. It's worship, in a sense. So that's a real privilege. And scientists do, I find, Christian scientists do use the word privilege when they talk about what they're doing. I wanted to talk to you about creativity, but I don't have time. I'm going to talk about imagination, which I think is more important. That's not more important, but it's a challenging topic that would be good to think about. I'm going to leave plenty of time at the end for people to talk about how you feel about this stuff or ask questions. You can tell me if you think this is important. It might be a surprise to think that science is imaginative, but it is inescapably the truth about science and in about the whole of life. And Douglas Headley, who's a philosopher of religion in Cambridge, has written a whole book on imagination, which I found extremely helpful, and he used this analogy of an amphibian. Because we're in two worlds. You know, we're in the physical world, the material world, but we also transcend it and think about it at a level that no other creature on earth can do. These little girls will do that much more overtly than you or I, well, probably, than you or I would. You know, they're running down the beach and they find a stick, and suddenly one of them is like, you're drowning and I'll rescue you, and off they go, you know. And then they run in the sea and they're squealing and they're little girls again, and then one of them picks up the stick again, and I'm the horse and you're the rider, go on, giddy up, you know, and off they go. And, you know, they're moving in and out, seamlessly out of the imaginative world and the real world, what we would call the real world, the material world. And we do that too. We just don't do it quite so obviously most of the time. So Douglas Headley said, the imagination is the basis of the distinctive amphibious capacity of human beings to be both part of a natural environment and to transcend the same environment. We are organisms, instinctively adapting to the world and interpreting it as reflective agents with memories and projections. And when I presented this to a group of students in a secular college, they were like, what are you trying to say? You know, we're not all religious. And, you know, they really, I may have used slightly more spiritual language when I described it, but they instantly saw the potential for what I was trying to say, you know, that we do this. But I think it is simply a fact of life. This is what we do. So let me define imagination a little more. Coleridge, the poet, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, has done quite a lot of work on this, and I think it was him who came up with these two categories of reproductive and productive imagination. So reproductive imagination is what you do at college. You learn stuff, and you come up with mental images. You store it all away, and you remember it all. That's one aspect of what you do. But, of course, you're at a good college, so you use your productive imagination too. You have to come up with new, you have to think for yourself, you have to solve problems, you have to come up with new concepts and new syntheses between the different subjects you do. You're not going to get a good mark unless you do that. I know, because I read one of the papers that you were doing today. And you have to be able to do that, you know, to show that you can really think for yourself. And we also, you know, every human being tells stories. So we take all those ideas that we've remembered and we jumble them up. And we find connections between them. We put them in new pigeonholes. So I want to think about how we do this, really using the productive imagination in both science and Christianity. And I said there are definitely some links. So there are three ways I kind of gleaned out of the stuff that I read. Where we use our imagination. First is just visually, in a sense, or pictures in your mind. We come up with mental pictures of things, thought experiments. Schrodinger's cat. I think this cat voluntarily climbed in the box. It's Christmas. He's like, look at me, I'm in the box. You know, there's the famous thought experiment of the cat's in the box and there's a radioactive source, and if it decays, the poison will be released, and is the cat alive or dead? And it's something to do with quantum mechanics, but I'm going to stop before I get myself into trouble because I'm not a physicist. But, you know, we come up with these quite elaborate thought experiments, and they can be extremely useful in, you know, moving science on and proposing new experiments that people should do to try them out whether the idea is good or not. And we do that in Christian faith too. You might imagine yourself by the shores of Lake Galilee. You can hear the waves. You can feel the stones under your feet. You can smell the fish. Jesus is talking. You're reading a story in the Bible and you're trying to imagine yourself there. What does this mean for you? How might Jesus interact with you? Or maybe you're hearing someone preach a sermon and saying, well, let's imagine that Jesus came back tomorrow. You know, and we work out some kind of scenario. So we do it all the time. So it's really, this is kind of a reaction against the idea that some people would say, you know, faith is about inventing stuff, you know, and science is about, you know, hard facts and reality. Neither are true. You know, faith is about evidence. Science is also involves imagination. Analogies, metaphors, symbols. Good teachers have to do this. You know, electricity is like people use, well, my physics teacher at school used plumbing illustrations, you know, for electricity. Maybe it's not a good analogy. Or, you know, if you're teaching about DNA, it might be like a string of pearls with four different colours of pearls, you know, and you come up with a code. You know, again, in our Christian faith, Jesus gave us symbols. I'm the light of the world, I'm the bread of life, communion. And they're deeply rooted in in our practices as Christians. Finally, on a larger scale, on a deeper scale, this set of assumptions that we use, the worldview that we have. When you go in a lab, you're working within a certain kind of set of rules and assumptions. First of all, that I can trust my cognitive abilities. And also assumptions like, you know, if I do the same experiment tomorrow and today, you know, I can repeat experiments. They can be repeatable because I'm trying to find things that stay constant, laws that stay constant. And a whole, you know, whole set of assumptions behind science. And obviously, the same with Christianity, that we're making sense of the world in a certain way. Obviously, this is a bigger scheme. I mean, I deliberately put science in a smaller box because I think science has a lot of limitations. You know, there's only so many things science can answer, whereas I think there's a difference there with the Christian worldview, which encompasses, has an explanation for everything. So we make sense of the world, and then once we've formed our assumptions, they affect our behaviour. And once you've learned how to do science, you're not going to go in the lab with a blue t-shirt on and say, my experiment didn't work because I wasn't wearing my pink t-shirt. Okay, you might say it sarcastically when you're frustrated, but you know it's completely not true. Okay, so it does affect your behaviour. If you embrace Christianity, you're going to behave differently, I hope. C.S. Lewis wrote an essay called Bluss Bells and Phalanspheres. You have to read the essay to understand why I put the weird words. But he talked about the fact that imagination is the organ of meaning. It comes up with, you know, what if it's like this? What if it means this? What if it means that? And reason is the organ of truth. So we have to test, come up with the idea, and then test it, come up with the meaning, and test it against reality. If Jesus is the light of the world, what does it mean? Is he the light of my life? Shall I try that out? Is he the light of anyone else's life? Is quantum mechanics a good, you know, way of thinking about matter? Let's try that. Let's do some experiments. So imagination, it can be disturbing, but I think it's really important to remember that imagination really does shape our view of the world, what we take in, what we remember. Changes our behaviour, our reproductive imagination. You know, we can sort things into different pigeonholes. When you're a kid, ice cream is in the pigeonhole of really good, eat as much as possible. Okay, as an adult, it's in the fattening pigeonhole, you know. I see people going into the cafeteria with just a small plate because they don't want to eat too much, you know. So you change your views of the world, change your behaviour. And then with our productive imagination, we change the ideas we have, the metaphors we use to explain life. They develop. And that's a good thing, because it's so easy to mislead ourselves, both in science and in Christian faith. Rowan Williams, our former archbishop, is a great scholar, said, sin is the condition of being seriously wrong about reality. I think it's very true. And you could write that on a laboratory wall as well. We were just talking over dinner about scientific fraud, you know. You think your idea is the greatest, and you will find evidence for it. So you fudge your paper so that you can, you know, get on with it. We have to test things against reality, and God helps us to do that. There's the whole story of C.S. Lewis, who, as a young man, believed that the world was meaningless. He was very depressed by this. He bought a novel on a train station, and it was by the Christian author George MacDonald. And he said this book baptized his imagination. It just gave him this other vision of reality. It was fiction, but it made him realize that there was more to life than just atoms and molecules. I read a book about this. You'll find it online by Baylor University. Harry Dearborn said, rather than leading him into an escape from reality, it washed away blinding scales and gave him a new vision of reality. So here's an interesting thing, that fiction helped a young man whose eyes were closed to the reality of the world to see reality again and go on to become an incredibly, you know, scholarly, logical thinker. It's great. another great quote I couldn't resist putting in, which really reflects the fact that if we are open to reality and we do discover reality, that can set us free to use our imaginations in the very best way possible. Francis Schaeffer said, the Christian is the really free man or woman, the one whose imagination should fly beyond the stars, which I think is great. So that's imagination, and there's a lot more to it than that. Of course, writing that chapter in the book made my brain hurt a lot. So that was your meat. I'll be interested to know what you think of that. Let's go on to beauty and awe. I like working on beauty because I get to use nice pictures. So when you let wonder drive you, you use your imagination and your creativity to the full, your outcome and the things you end up working on, you might find truly beautiful. Marie Curie said this, "I belong in the ranks of those who have cultivated the beauty that is the distinctive feature of scientific research." And I haven't yet met a scientist who thinks the systems they work on are ugly. You might prove me wrong tonight, but I haven't yet met anyone who thinks that. So you could be cynical and just say, well, you stare at anything long enough, you think it's great. You know, you're going to say it's beautiful. We can talk about that later. But let me define beauty, first of all. You could define it as something simply that is pleasing to the senses. We could get all complicated and philosophical. But I think for a scientist, generally, that's what they're talking about when they say something is beautiful. They like it. You know, it's a good colour, it's got a lovely pattern. And also there's probably something more abstract about it that appeals to their intellect too. So you could look at the symmetry of the ice crystals. You might know something about the butterfly's wing. You certainly might know something about the hummingbird's flight or the aurora. You know, you know this abstract stuff that helps you to find it more beautiful. And some people, mostly beauty seems to be a matter of taste, but some people think it's an indicator of truth. So I'll give you a few kinds of beauty we find in science. We can test this out. This is Jeff Hardin, who's a professor of zoology at Madison University in Wisconsin. And, and he studies C. elegans worms. They don't move this fast. But they are transparent, and I'm a biology geek. I think they're beautiful. And we know it. Let me show it again. I like it. Okay. There we go. It'd be fun if they could go that fast. The entire development has been mapped out. They're so simple. Every single cell, you know where it's going to go next. Okay, someone's made this whole massive map of C. elegans. I'm told the guy who did it wore a rut in his lab floor, going from his microscope to his bench to record his observations. But for someone like Jeff, who's studying the development of this animal all the time, he said knowing the steps in a complicated bit of ballroom dancing leads to greater appreciation for the skill of the dancers. And it's the same with C. elegans. Watching these tiny embryos in exquisite detail using powerful microscopes gives us a deep sense for the intricate cellular choreography that built their bodies. So you might not be able to appreciate the 2-millimeter worm, but he certainly thinks it's beautiful. So there's the sort of visual beauty. Then there's the more abstract kind of beauty. I've got an equation up there. Physicists and mathematicians often think their equations are beautiful because they're kind of simple or symmetrical or, you know, some kind of unity about them. There's also the beauty of the experimental system. Got some plants here. You know, you might... As you work on it, as you know, or maybe you're learning how to do an experiment, and then you really do it well, and someone says, "Oh, that's a really nice experiment. It's really nice data. You've done that beautifully." You know, there's the beautiful beauty of doing it, then there's also the beauty that you introduce. I've got a picture of that. The beauty you introduce into your data by interpreting it, by making it different colours or presenting it in a certain way, which you can give it to yourself, making a movie. So all sorts of different kinds of beauty. But where does it take us? What does it make us think about? Well, for some people, it takes us beyond science into other questions, philosophical questions. A cell biologist called Ursula Goodenough, would say she's not religious, not any kind of religion, but she's interested in ultimate questions. That was kind of the phrase that she had. And she said, "The remarkable beauty of the cell, if everything it is, continues to draw me to spiritual issues." Now, there's a bridge between science and faith, if ever I saw one. And these people who write this kind of thing are very quotable, and I think we should be drawing them into discussions about science and faith more often. and asking people like Richard Dawkins, do you agree with this statement? You know, do you agree? And he's really into awe and wonder. Can we have discussions about this? Can we find out any common ground for this, for our discussion? I think that would be fascinating. And then, of course, you can add a Christian element to that, Christian dimension. And Jeff Hardin, who's a committed Christian, very involved in InterVarsity and Biologue, all sorts of Christian activities. I could talk about the theologian Rudolf Otto's sense of the numinous, which is a spiritual kind of feeling. But is there something more concrete than that? Is it, as the biblical scholar Tom Wright says, an echo of a voice? I would like to suggest to my colleagues, including Ursula Goodenough, that creation itself is calling out to us, saying something about the Creator. So I think we need to get these people talking to each other. So, in other words, for Jeff, the beauty of the world reflects something of God's beauty. And I think we need to be careful before we go too far with that, because we're starting to do natural theology, I have to not lose sight of the Bible, okay? So we can find out stuff about the world, but it needs to be carefully discerned because it's so easy to start making stuff up or to see the suffering that we see in the world, and then, you know, it's difficult to understand why is there beauty, why is there suffering. We need the Bible, we need to know Jesus. But there is beauty there, and we can appreciate it. And I'll finish the section of beauty with another few pictures of both biological and astronomical things. C.S. Lewis, I go back to C.S. Lewis again. This keeps happening, kept happening in this project, because he's so wise. He said in an essay called The Weight of Glory, which you can find free online. I think you can find Blossbells and Phalanspheres free online. I can't remember. I'm sure it's in the library here. He said, we want everything to be beautiful. We want to grab on and hold on to the beauty with both hands and not let it go away. We want almost as if you're putting your faith in it. But that's not it. Okay, this is just a foretaste of what's to come. This is awaken something in us. We long for it. We want everything to be tidy and, you know, nice colours and, you know, ordered. We want our experiments to work. But that's because it's awakened in us this desire, C.S. Lewis has said, for our own far-off country. It's a good reason to do natural theology or to look at the world and think about what it tells us, because, you know, it might awaken something in us when we see that beauty. We're longing for the new heaven and new earth that were promised in Revelation. So that's a few thoughts about beauty. I'll just remind you of the definitions. I'll leave my computer plugged in just in case the projector decides to start working. So awe is the stood still. You know, I was just about to say stood still in wonder, but I just distinguished between awe and wonder, didn't I? You're stood still, thinking, wow, you know, look at that. I'll tell you a story that will help to illustrate that. This is Bob Sluka. He's a marine conservationist, and he did his PhD in the Bahamas, as you do, most of the time he was paddling around in really beautiful clear water, and then, you know, one day they were counting fish. You could virtually count the fish off the side of the boat. The water was so clear. And then one day they had to go into a deeper part that was actually over a 2 kilometre deep trench. And cold, dark, and he's there with his dive buddy, and they're looking at the fish, trying to count the fish on the side of the reef, and they're not thinking about what's below. But then after a while he sees something moving down there and thinks, it's okay, I'm a marine biologist, I can handle this. And it comes nearer and nearer, and suddenly there's this whoosh like a jet going past him. And he's looking in the face of, I've forgotten the name, barracuda. And huge, great big teeth. I think this is terrifying, but for him, this was a very special moment. Because after the initial, he thought, it's okay, these things don't normally bite people. I like that in this story there was a normally, and he was happy with that. Okay, I guess it takes that to be a marine biologist. And he's staring this thing. It's just checking him out. you know, his, these things grow to a couple of meters long, you know, and he's taking them out, and he's like, relax, you know, and he's just hanging there in the water, hanging out with the barracuda, and they're checking each other out, and he's thinking, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to protect these things. I want to help people to learn about the ocean. And for him, that was a really formative moment. I think for me, that would make me want to never go diving ever again. But for him, it was a very special moment. It was a moment of awe. And so awe is much more powerful than wonder. It's rarer. And it's also, I think, harder to sustain. I think anyone who's been a Christian for very long will realize you can't keep that sense of marvel at God every second of the day. You know, it just doesn't stay. And the you can think about this in terms of the universe. This is Jocelyn Bell Burnell. She was involved in discovering pulsars, contributed to a new Nobel Prize. And I heard her speak, and somebody said, how do you hold all the numbers in your head? And she said, well, I don't. We work in pairs of 10, so you don't really think about the scales you're working on. You kind of couldn't. You couldn't really function if you did that. And she's not the only astronomer I've heard say that. You know, you just can't hold it in your head. It's when she said she really enjoys explaining it to people, because then you see their jaws drop, you know, and you're trying to, oh, really? And then she starts enjoying it herself. Oh, yeah, that's what I work on. That's really cool. She didn't quite use those words. But she, you know, so it's hard to wrap your head around, so you only experience it from time to time. And a Jesuit philosopher called Enrico Cantor, who wrote a wonderful book that's full of quotes from scientists who have experienced awe and wonder and beauty and spiritual moments in their work. He interviewed a whole load of scientists, and he came up with a conclusion that the mystery of the universe is not in ignorance, it's not in what we don't know, but it's in something, the universe, that is so intelligible, we can understand so much about it, sometimes we just can't take it in. Okay, we can take it in bits and pieces. We can't hold it all in our head. You can never learn it all. And it's just amazing that we can know. It's being dazzled. He said it's like the darkness. The mystery is like the darkness that is felt when one is overwhelmed by dazzling light. So, and I think I see that if you look at quotes from, you know, go through Nobel Prize talks, you know, and see the kinds of words they use, you might get this sense. And for some scientists, this is something deeply spiritual. Einstein used spiritual words a lot. He said, the most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is the sense of the mysterious. It is the underlying principle of religion as well as all serious endeavor in art and science. Now, Einstein didn't believe in God. He didn't. He wasn't part of a traditional religion, but he believed there was a kind of a capital M sort of mind. In the universe. He said, you know, there's this sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our minds cannot grasp, whose beauty and sublimity reaches us only indirectly. And that was kind of one of his, you know, big things. And that's about as close as I've ever heard, you know, a scientist, not a Christian, talk about God, you know, but there certainly was, and there was certainly this whole generation of physicists, Einstein and Heisenberg and a whole load of others who use this kind of language, I feel. I've come across quite a number of them who use that kind of language. Sometimes feeling a little bit uncomfortable, it was a conversation, I can't remember if it was Heisenberg or someone else, and he was saying there's a something, there's a mind or a soul or, you know, and he couldn't bring himself to quite articulate it because, you know, he had a sense there was something there, but he didn't want anyone to think he believed in God or his companion that he was talking to. And these are glimpses of what Alistair McGrath would call the transcendent, experiences that reach beyond the realm of normal human experience. So Edwin Hubble is another, there he is with his pipe. I guess they didn't know tobacco was bad for you back then. He said, sometimes through a strong, compelling experience of mystical insight, a man knows beyond the shadow of doubt that he has been in touch with the reality that lies behind beyond mere phenomena. He himself is completely convinced, but he cannot communicate the certainty. It is a private revelation. He may be right, but unless we share his ecstasy, we cannot know. So there's someone who's quite, you know, happy to use that kind of language. And of course, for a Christian, when you feel that kind of sense, that would help you to turn, you can turn that to God in a sense of gratefulness, in a sense of worship. And there's a long, long tradition of people doing scientific research as an act of worship, and which many of the people in this room are continuing. I'll give you just one example before I finish. When I wrote the book, you know, there's so many good examples of people doing this, so many quotable people. But this is one story of a man from Cambridge, John Ray, who's one of the founding botanists in the world. He was a fellow of Trinity College, which meant at that point he was ordained as well, and he was one of the ones who took it really seriously, that his ordination, he preached in chapel, and because his botany was part of his worship of God, he used to sometimes give lectures in chapel too. I think that's great. Unfortunately, I did sit in Trinity College chapel thinking, did his students sit here? But they've changed all the woodwork since he was there, sadly. He said this: there is for a free man no occupation more worthy and delightful than to contemplate the beauteous works of nature. So that was, for him, it was a really big deal. And I think that's great. So, I lied. One more. Jeff Hardin, when you go on a hike and there's a beautiful view that not many people know about, the natural response is to want to share that with somebody. Come and look. He said, I think the same is true in science, and as a Christian, I want to share that discovery with God itself. It becomes an act of worship for me. Science and faith explain different aspects of reality. They deeper wonder can lead to a deeper sense of worship of God. We use our imaginations to make sense of the world in both Christianity and science. Beauty in the world can give us some inklings of how incredible God is, and what we see can move us to awe and lead us to worship. So my perspective in this is deliberately the glass is half full. So this is all the most positive stuff. Of course it's hard to work in a lab, of course there are loads of issues, but I think we do need to consider this kind of stuff as well. So I'll leave you with my shameless book promotion of the God and the Lamb, my previous project, Test of Faith. So I'm very keen now to hear what you think. What's your perspective? Do you experience this kind of thing? Do you have questions? What are the things you want to share? Don't be shy, yes.
So I think you alluded to this a little bit, but can that sense of wonder and worship be cultivated, or how did it develop? And I'm also kind of asking in the context of, like, my own experience is that sometimes it's hard to have wonder past, like, my own ego and ideas about nature as opposed to nature itself, let alone the next step of possibility.
Yeah, so you're pleased with what you've discovered rather than thinking, yeah, no, and it's very common. And that's what Enrico Cantor said. You know, often there's this, you could feel like you just invented something, but then you realize, no, it's nothing to do with me, I just found it. Lying on the floor and looked it up from there. Can we cultivate wonder? Oh, yeah, I am sure. Yeah, and I think taking time. I mean, some of the nicest pictures I took in the lab were when I was just mucking about with a microscope, you know. Wasting time in a sense, you know, trying to take nice pictures. Or Rhoda Hawkins said the way she cultivated wonder, one was she would kind of lose it and get a bit dry. She'd been working too hard, and she would go to conferences, hear her colleagues, and be inspired by what they've been doing and their ideas, and wow, you know, look how much progress they made. That's a very humble approach for her. And then also just around going outside, you know. She said it was, she refreshed, filled up her sense of wonder by, you know, being surrounded by nature. I know that there are lots of other more experienced scientists here that know how you cultivate them. Thanks to Cheryl. Or else get you.
I'm in Bible study fellowship in studying Moses this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're talking about reminded me of in Numbers 12. It's talking about Miriam and Aaron are kind of jealous of Moses because it looks like God is talking to him,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not getting any of the credit for any of the things that they say. And this is an interesting little section. This is Numbers 12, basically 1 through 9. And if you'll let me just read it, just so you can get the flavor here. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife. Well, that wasn't really why. And then they said, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses?" they asked. "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" And the Lord heard this. Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. At once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out to the tent of meeting, all three of you." So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance to the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. When both of them stepped forward, he said, "Listen to my words." Now he's going to distinguish between a prophet and a servant. Moses was a true servant. "When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams." And I thought about the awe and mysteriousness of science, and how we sometimes come up with sudden realizations when we're doing an experiment. We almost feel like it's a God thing. Well, what happened here? Oh, yeah, I understand now. Well, then he says, the Lord says, "But this is not true of the servant, Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, Moses?" The anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them, and later they died. But anyway, I found that very interesting, that God has these, points out these two different types of communication that he has with human beings. And in this area of sometimes mysterious things, I wondered if you... In thinking about all that you're doing, which is great, do you ever get into the into coincidences that are, in retrospect, surprising? You know, a lot of people, I'll bet there's a lot of people here that have personal experiences where you've met somebody and it just sort of changed the direction of your life, or there's a lot of things that happen. I was on a pastoral search committee, and someone had this idea. She went out in the garden to work on some vegetables, and she brought a radio, and on the radio they mentioned a certain person. Well, that person had been mentioned on the steering committee as somebody that they knew. Well, she talked about that at the next committee meeting. And over a series of times, we ended up with about, we started keeping track of these coincidences.
Right, yeah.
We ended up with like 4 pages of bona fide coincidences. Just seemed like God was pointing.
Yeah, no, I didn't get into answers to prayer and things like that. But certainly, one of the scientists, when I talked about, there's a chapter about what it's like to work in the lab, and he definitely felt, rightly or wrongly, he felt he was in a place where God was revealing things to him. It's really hard to articulate that in a way that doesn't sound like, I'm special and God's, making me a good scientist. But he definitely felt a sense of privilege that he could discover things. So, yeah. Any other questions? Or, yeah.
Have you ever
I learned things that I recall later that I can think, yes, this is a wonderful work. Even though maybe at the time I'm thinking, gosh, I have to do this experiment again, I did it wrong, But later, or maybe at the time I had a conversation with a colleague who was looking down microscopes and we were like, wow, this is amazing stuff. We were there for hours, but we just had this moment when we were just, and he was telling me how it made him feel, and also it's kind of a sort of finding fire kind of thing as well, that it tests you and you have to persevere, and it's a character formation thing as well.
So you talked about how wonder and imagination and these things can start conversation between Christians and not Christians. Have you ever considered how these same principles can start conversations between people in different disciplines who are all Christians? So, I was recognizing how the idea of, wonder at something can help me have conversations with people who study, anthropology or something.
Yeah. No, definitely, and that's partly why I picked those topics, because there are plenty of people who think, oh, I'm not a scientist, I'm creative, or, the cliche, or I'm not good at science, or, no, this isn't going to connect to my life. So I wanted to pick topics that any human being, especially in our culture, we value. And I think certainly going into the theology faculty library and meeting stuff, I learned a lot. I think we really do need to have these interdisciplinary conversations.
And that there's imagination in other disciplines.
Yeah.
So it's we can both talk about imagination that we learn from different perspectives.
Yeah, and that can be helpful spiritually as well, as you understand how we use our imagination in general. Yeah.
How would you integrate this idea of increasing wonder through science with ethical questions about limiting science for the sake of ethics?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So you mean you could get so lost in wonder that you just do crazy things in the end? Yeah. I think most of the people I'm interviewing here are doing basic science, so they're producing knowledge that you can use in a variety of ways. You could use it for good, you could use it for evil. So I feel almost that's another step further. And obviously when you write your grant, you need to consider how this knowledge will be used. So before you get lost in wonder, or before you continue to get lost in wonder, you have to, why are you doing this? Why do you want the money for it? What are you going to do with it? What is someone else going to do with it? So I think, maybe if wonder is a driver of research, then, there are other things that are involved there as well. Yeah, responsible research.
How does religion play a part in the theory of evolution?
I'm tempted to. We could go down a long track on this. Can I turn it around? Can I turn your question around? I'm going to leave the question of how compatible creation and evolution are, because it's such a long question. But I'd love to turn it around and say there are things I can think about in evolutionary biology that help me to learn stuff or make me think about things. For example, I have a colleague in Cambridge University who's a paleobiologist, and he's also a Christian, called Simon Conway Morris, and he saw American evolutionary biologist, paleobiologist, put forward this idea of evolution that was quite nihilistic. It was just nothing means anything, and it was clearly an ideological bias. So Simon Conway Morris really disagreed with this bias and said, well, what do we see? And actually what he could see was that rather than being this meaningless jumble, he could see trends in evolutionary biology. Things develop eyes, it just happens. He's saying, well, I think you see this happening over and over again things develop jointed legs. You know, and it sounds like quite a basic thing, but it's huge. You know, it's a huge advance. And he's saying, well, maybe there are well-trodden paths that things are going on, and you can explain that scientifically, but also it's compatible with the idea of a meaning or a purpose. So there is some stuff in evolutionary biology that can make you think. Yeah.
Wow.
So we'll hear, and then there's a
couple. Yeah. How do you distinguish, or do you distinguish, between science fantasy, science fiction, and truth in the imaginative sense?
Yeah, and that's the really important question, and again, something I've been talking about recently. And I mean, the whole way science is set up is to filter that out. So, you know, you come up with all your ideas, and some of them would be really wild, and, you know, you're working in a lab with a lot of people. So, you know, as you try out your ideas and you tell people about them, usually everything gets mentioned in the lab meeting. Everybody does their first presentation to the rest of your group, you know, and as you say your ideas, some of them will be like, you what? You know, or if you're a student and you're, please can I buy these chemicals so I can do this experiment? And your supervisor says, no, you know, that's a really bad idea. Now, it might be a great idea. Maybe, you know, sometimes ideas get squashed and people just do it anyway and it turns out well. But often, with experience, you can have a pretty good idea. You're not just making random stabs in the dark, you know. But everything has to get tried out, experiments. And even if your experiments go a certain direction, you publish a paper, nobody, certainly in biology, nobody's really going to take it as seriously until someone else has reproduced it in another lab. And if they can't, they're going to be like, well, what did you do? Did you spit in it? You know, like, what was going on? And people are going to start asking questions. And then if there is scientific fraud going on, which is rare, but it happens, people will eventually notice, you know, either these two graphs from these two papers look identical and they're supposed to be about different things, or, you know, no one can reproduce your results. What on earth did you do? Didn't you teach anyone to do it? No, well, sorry. You know, so I think those are the kind of filters are there. That in the same in theology, that if you write a crazy book, you know, you might be popular for a while, but, you know, unless anyone else that anyone else trusts is going to, you know, come up with some solid support for it, then you're just going to go by the wayside. I think the kind of tests are going to be there. Yeah. You don't want to fund his eyes. Yeah. I think, is there a question over here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, in response to the question about evolution of faith, the biology student advisory council is sponsoring a, early having a student host a discussion on next Monday.
Good. Go. Yeah. And Biologos is another organization that does fabulous resources online. The ASA has resources online. And Test of Faith, the material that I used to work on, is another course to work through thinking about science and faith. It might be in the library. Someone might have a copy here. Sure. Now, is there? Did you? No? Okay. Sorry. I saw another hand up there. Is anyone else? We're going to finish in a few minutes, but is anyone else want to anything?
Well, as another question, I was fascinated by the quote that you gave from Heisenberg. I'm not sure I can quote that. Can you quote that again, what Heisenberg said?
I had a couple of ones. Was it...
something about the explanation of not creating dynamics.
Oh, yeah. I try so hard to get these people in context, and I hope I did. Correct me if I didn't. When one stumbles upon these very simple great connections, the whole thing appears in a different light. This was making sense of data. Then our inner eyes suddenly open to a connection which has always been there, also without us, and which is quite obviously not created by man.
So one of the themes that I like to promote is that a good scientist isn't really inventing truth. He's not creating truth. He's discovering truth.
Yeah, it's exactly. And when I talk about creativity, so many people who write about creativity say, you know, we can't make anything from scratch. Only God does that. And actually, some people are not comfortable using the word creativity. In fact, it wasn't really used until the 18th century, or maybe a little bit earlier, because God is creative. We are not creative, but we're kind of secondarily creative. We take what we can see and what's there. You know, there's the joke about the man who challenges God to, I can make life, and God says, okay, show me, and he gets, right, first I take some dirt, and God's like, your own dirt. You know, we can't do it, you know. But that's okay. I mean, J.R.R. Tolkien coined the term like sub-creation. You know, we're copying God. We're using our creative gifts to make stuff out of the things. You know, he has a really nice little phrase. You know, it's like we're a little child copying our dad. You know, trying to, you know, puts it in a nice light. Creativity is a whole other subject. Science is so creative. I didn't have time. Well, if there are no more questions or opinions, then thank you for your interaction. And I hope this will leave you with some questions.